Support for the Capital Connection comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustino. With us, oh my goodness, he's back again. Blair Horner, Senior Policy Advisor for NYPIRG. Find out more at NYPIRG, NYPIRG.org. Blair does commentary here at WAMC in the interest of full disclosure and serves on the WAMC Board of Trustees. But he is a man who tries to seek the truth about New York State government and politics. Are lawmakers truthful, Blair?
And good morning to you.
Wait. Blair Horner, welcome to the Capital Connection. Our politician, you know, I thought about this last night. Honestly, Blair, I was thinking, you know, with all your experience, is it that the individual, it's about the individuals and their character? Or is it the system that ultimately needs correction? Or is it a combination of both?
Well, certainly the system needs to be improved. There's no doubt about that. I mean, individuals are individuals. Humans are humans. You have, you know, angels, you have devils, you have all the rest of us in between, right? And so the systems that you want to design are ones that grab the devils and put them in the pokey and also create sort of the guardrails so that all the rest of us in the middle, you know, stay on the straight and narrow. It's the same thing, sort of like a speed trap on the thruway, right? I mean, people drive faster when they don't see them. They slow down when they see them.
That's right.
And so if there are those type of guardrails in terms of campaign finance, in terms of ethics and lobbying, you know, the traditional stuff, then things work better. And, you know, in fairness, in recent years, things appear to have been better through some of the changes and through some of the high-profile corruption cases that, you know, hammered the Capitol.
Give us one example, Blair.
Well, there was the former Speaker of the Assembly, former Senate Majority Leader, both went to the pokey. One
died. Who are they? I mean, who the heck were they?
Yeah, I know. Only your listeners.
Sheldon
may...
Silva,
Joe Skelos.
Gene Skelos. That's I almost went with Joe Bruno and the horse.
That's right. He dodged the bullet.
Yeah, he did.
He got convicted once, and then the U.S. Supreme Court decision said
theft of honest services law.
That's right. And that the U.S. Supreme Court has consistently narrowed prosecutors' ability to use that statute, and at the same time, so. Therefore making it hard to bring corruption cases. At the same time, they've advanced campaign finance decisions, which mean that we're awash in money from rich individuals. Elon Musk spent $250 million to help Donald Trump get elected. So the whole system that you see, that we see and that often we're revolted by in America, not just New York, but in America, is the result of U.S. Supreme Court decisions that have really unlocked the bank.
Conservative, right? Conservative U.S. Supreme Court decisions.
Yeah, I mean, they interpret, you know, I've read the U.S. Constitution. They interpret part of it to say that if you want to spend as much money to influence elections, you can.
And corporations are people.
That's right. And corporations are people. So there's that, right? There's that sort of stinky milieu that permeates the whole country. At the state level, though, there are things you can still do. You can set ethical standards. You can place guardrails on what lobbyists have to at least report. And we can set up voting systems that make it as easy as possible for people to vote, unless, of course, the Congress changes that. So there are some things the state can do, and the state has been, you know, sort of on a zigzag path of making that happen.
But there's something that undergirds all of it that's the most anti-democratic thing we know, redistricting.
Yep.
Now, just talk about that for a second. We see what's happening now after Texas went for the, let's do a mid-year redistricting act. Now it's approved for California.
Right.
New York says they're going to do it. I don't like this at all. I say pox on both their houses. A lot of people will say, well, if they do it, we're doing
it. That's exactly right. And that's the rationale. You know, it's a race to the bottom. Who can rig elections the best?
It should be illegal.
In fact, but the U.S. Supreme Court, again, is their decisions are opening the door to this sort of Wild West, this Gilded Age version of America.
The conservative majority Supreme Court.
I'm not even sure if it's conservative, though, right? I mean, conservatives believe in tradition. This is not traditional.
The modern definition.
Unless you're throwing it back to the 1890s.
I agree.
I mean, you know, Eisenhower was a conservative. George H.W. Bush was a conservative. They didn't advance these kinds of proposals.
So then what do you call it?
It's a radical distortion of the interpretation of the Constitution. I'm not a lawyer, but that's how I see it. And I think it's made the country worse and weaker because it accelerates the divisions that we see in America. And as a result, we have, you know, depends how you look at it, I suppose. But in my view, you know, you have bad foreign policy that is going to hurt our country going forward. You have lousy environmental laws that are going to ruin the planet. And all of that gets accelerated because of this sort of radical interpretation of what the U.S. Constitution says.
And let's get rid of the checks and balances. I mean, I just talked to the Inspector General, Lucy Lange of New York, who was here to celebrate the 40th birthday of the Inspector General's office. We talked all the way back to Baron von Steuben. But the point is that on the national level, you see what Trump has done with the Inspector Generals, purging them.
Let me just stick a little pin in that, though, because in New York, the New York Inspector General reports to the secretary to the governor. So is that sufficient independence?
No. And I asked her, are you going to be able to be independent? I always ask the Inspector General, whoever it is, that question.
Again, I haven't seen any indication. It really is up to the governor, right? If the governor is willing to say, okay, you do your thing.
Absolutely.
Then she does her thing. And we've seen other Inspector Generals do incredibly independent, hard-hitting reports that hurt the governor.
Yeah.
But we've also seen inspector generals that don't do it. And I mean, the most recent example is when there was the then ethics agency was looking at whether or not to punish a top aide to Governor Cuomo, Joseph Prococo. And there was a behind closed doors secret meeting where they were discussing what to do. And Governor Cuomo, was reported, calls up the Speaker of the Assembly and, you know, complains about what Hastie's, the Speaker of the Assembly's appointees, were saying in a private meeting. So the Inspector General is supposed to look into that. She never interviews the governor. So, like, the obvious question is, how did you find out? Right. But she never asks. And so there's an indication of the fact that you don't have a long leash, you have a short leash as Inspector General, could harm the public's interest. But there are instances. There was an Inspector General, a guy named Joe Fish, who did a very powerful examination of how, I think it was casino gambling, but gambling in general, the interests were influencing state government that led to problems for state senators and then Governor Patterson. And so it doesn't mean you end up with some, but if you leave it up to the human, that's why the question you asked in the very beginning about institutions versus people, you got to have the institutions, right? And so an inspector general that has the sufficient independence to do her job right is an important thing. And I think New York should actually go fix that law while they're at it.
Will they?
Hope springs eternal, David.
There it is. Blair Horner is with us. He is the senior policy advisor at NYPIRG. That's the New York Public Interest Research Group. Well, Blair, the governor has unveiled her $260 billion budget plan this coming fiscal year. And you have written about this. You call it a difficult political triple play, is one of your phrases in here. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, the governor's budget has to deal with a lot of different big pieces. So one is the Trump administration and the Congress's agreement on the one big, beautiful bill that basically savages health insurance in New York and can throw tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands of people's health insurance out the window, which could be a life or and death decision. And so that's a huge thing. So how do you cover for that with existing resources? Well, the state is facing a tight fiscal scenario this year and certainly going in years forward. Also, the newly elected mayor of the city of New York wants to expand programs that cost money, and he's facing a budget deficit. So there's New York City, there's federal government, and then there's sort of just balancing the normal budget to begin with. So that's three big things. And it seems like she was able to do it by that the revenues coming into the state are exceeded what they had projected, particularly because of Wall Street's cooking. And also, I think they're rifling through the sofa cushions of state government trying to find any pots of money that is hiding away, because this year, after all, is an election year. And that's not a good year to raise taxes or to cut service.
No. And, you know, when you look at the governor's task here, it seems like she's had to make some reversals, for example, from where she started. Let's take the environment. You see, the first thing that begins to happen is when Trump comes in, he takes Lee Zeldin, the former New York congressman, makes him the head of the EPA, you know, the regulatory agency, and then they remove the regulations. She can see where that's going.
Yep.
So now she sort of has shifted. You said the New York government used the budget to undermine New York's climate law, and you see that she's also shifted because of this, I think, this message coming from Washington toward nuclear.
Yeah, when it comes to climate policy, there's a lot of, like, weird stresses. And so what's happening is under the umbrella of affordability, the governor is trying to deal, is basically walking away from climate law, the climate law in New York. The state set up a law in 2019, set ambitious goals, science-based ambitious goals to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in New York State. And while New York State is only, you know, 5% or 6% of the country's population, it is the 10th or 11th biggest economy in the world. And so what New York does can have a global impact, and that what you're dealing with climate change is a global problem. So New York is walking away under this guise of affordability. But when you look at it, the affordability argument doesn't square with this, right? It's because the propaganda machine from big oil has made affordability, that the climate laws are the problems with affordability. Yet you look across the country, electricity rates are going up everywhere. So it's not about New York's climate law. You could make a criticism of New York's climate law, which is the Cuomo and Hochul administrations have not done anywhere near enough to make it happen. So how, if they haven't made it happen, how could the climate law be the problem, right? Also, there are states that have increases in utility rates that don't have climate laws. So what's going on? Now, you add to that the nuke stuff. Now, the nuke stuff is, again, the Biden administration and the Congress passed a law to make it easier to build nukes. And part of the argument, and there's a policy rationale, which is they don't emit greenhouse gases. Now, you still have to mine it and truck stuff around, but whatever. They don't emit greenhouse gases, and we do face a climate challenge.
So it's the only real thing that can
the most expensive way to do it.
Yep.
So how does that work with affordability? If you really cared about affordability and you really cared about climate, you'd be moving solar in a huge way. You know,
oh, come on, Blair. Scientists tell us that you can't do it with just solar.
No, but that's not true. So, for example, Germany, cloudy, cold. I've lived there. You know, it's sort of like New York, but maybe New York might even be a little bit nicer in terms of its climate. They do 15% solar now.
Das ist gut.
Sehr gut. And so why can't we? We're at five, under five, actually. And so the European Union, which is a collection of a whole bunch of countries, they're doing upwards, I believe, to 50% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2030. And New York's nowhere near that. So how is that possible unless we're not trying?
Oh, Blair, Germany's so small. We could fit 200 Germanys in the United States. They have a great public transportation system. They're more capable of doing it in a size of a country like that than we are here. Come on.
The European Union has more people in it than the United States does.
We're talking about Germany.
And when I was talking about Germany on solar, I was comparing it to New York. I mean, there are states in the United States, Texas, for example, California being another, that do pump out a lot of solar power, but they're sunny. And so it's not really fair. So to compare New York to Saudi Arabia, for example, wouldn't be right. But to compare it to Germany is about right. And Germany, now Germany has three times as many people, but they've still been able to generate three times as much solar power. And so why aren't we talking about solar power all the time instead of nukes? You still have the same problem with nukes, which is where do you put the waste? You still have the same problem with nukes about what do you do about evacuating people if there's a problem? And the state is currently pumping $500 million a year to keep the old ones that we have running. So how does that help affordability? So the cheapest way to generate power is solar. The safest way for the environment to deal with it is solar. Why aren't we pushing pedal to the metal to make solar happen?
Well, you know why. It's because we have an administration in Washington that is bent on not doing any things. They're trying to cancel wind projects, and they want to do more clean coal. And they think it's a woke issue.
I know. They made it a culture war issue. That's absolutely.
And what do you do then?
Well, one thing you don't do is bad things. And so the state of New York controls its own fate, you know, in terms of its own laws. It has its own state constitution. What's the most effective way to and the most affordable way to generate electricity?
I think you said solar.
Is solar. And so why not be pushing that hard? Push it hard. And yet, this is going to have downsides. People are going to be mad because they don't like to look at solar panels across the street.
I think they look great.
You know, there'll be people that don't like to have them, you know, filling up empty spaces or on top of buildings. There's all sorts of problems, right? But you got to tackle it. And the problems of solar are not nearly the same kinds of problems in terms of scale as nuclear. And so you know, the waste problem still hasn't been solved. We've been told that for decades that they were going to do that. Effectively being stored on site forever.
Yep.
You still have to figure out how to evacuate cities that are anywhere near these places in case there's ever a problem. You got to have that stuff on the book. God knows how that would work. First responders are supposed to run to the plants if there's a meltdown. Then no one's going to do that. They're going to go the other way.
And if they're bidded out, I want the highest bidder to win, not the lowest bidder.
Well, again, I don't even, like, who knows what's going to happen, right? The governor's talked a lot about these small modular reactors, SMRs.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They're not even commercially available in the United States yet, right? So it's like, well, that's going to take time.
Wish list.
And she wants to build another big one, though. And that's been a source of controversy because they tend to, you know, they tend to be very costly to build. Their costs usually overrun. They take years to build. The problem of climate change is now you can put up a solar panel pretty quick.
But upstate counties are saying, hey, I'm in.
People want the jobs.
Yeah.
That's why labor supports it, too. People want the jobs. The downsides, though, you have to look at it societally. What's the best, fastest, cheapest way to produce electricity that doesn't harm the environment or does the least damage to the environment? That ends up being solar.
Just one last thing on this environment. Wasn't there just a recent decision that those places, those states that produce a lot of pollution that ends up downwind and hitting the Northeast, weren't they given a reprieve? They took away some of the regulations there?
Well,
they can't be held responsible, I guess?
The federal government has been doing everything they can to sort of undermine, enforcement of environmental laws across the board. So this would be among them. One of the things that we're concerned about is the state passed a law 2 years ago called the Climate Change Superfund Act, which tags the oil companies $3 billion a year for each of the next 25 years to pay for the costs, the infrastructure costs, of damage due to climate change. Bridge gets washed out. Under current law, you taxpayers have to pay for it. In the future, the oil companies would have to help pay for it. The Department of Justice, under the Trump administration, has sued to block that law. The big oil folks are suing to block that law. Red state attorney generals are suing to block that law. If they succeed, New Yorkers will have to see a tax hike of $3 billion a year to cover the cost of climate damages. So all of these people that are fighting to protect big oil are doing so in New York, where the impact will be to raise taxes, basically, because how else are you going to pay for the new bridge? So it's really going to come up to the House Republicans in New York to block that. I mean, you have a razor-thin majority in the Congress, in the House, and if enough of them, the handful of them, said, well, we can't do that because to do that means we're voting for a tax hike in New York, sanity may prevail in terms of whether or not the Congress would act. God knows what the courts will do.
We'll see where that goes. Well, Blair, let's turn to another topic today. You've written in a column, New York policymakers have hammered public support for private colleges found in the unrestricted aid to independent colleges university program known as Bundy Aid. You've talked with me about this before.
Sure.
But the aid directs financial support to independent colleges. You see a problem with this. Many colleges have seen their finances become damaged or worse.
Yeah, I mean, colleges, of course, play an important role in our society. They produce the future leaders of the country in many ways. They produce both in political terms, but also in sort of industrial terms, business terms, human service terms, education, etc. I mean, you know, generally speaking, you have all sorts of people going to college, right? You have old geezers, too. But it's primarily sort of churning where the young adults get engaged civically and learn about the world.
And I would just add that the colleges are now wrapped up in the culture wars as well.
Yeah, I mean, our society has its problems. Let's just put that aside for the moment. But also colleges, both public and private, are like little economic engines wherever you put them.
Sure.
The students come into town and they get counted in the census as living there. So that helps. They crank out, pizza, whatever the heck it is in the community in terms. They stimulate small business activity. The faculty that work there, the staff that work there, they all have jobs. They live in the community, sort of a creative class to some extent.
Any public-private partnerships they form?
Right. There's all sorts of things that happen. It's roughly every dollar you put into a college, public dollar, you get eight back in return in economic development.
Pretty good investment.
Yeah. And it's unlike a lot of the other economic development things like, that New York has, wasted money on.
Which have ended up in scandal.
Well, there's that. And, like a movie studio in Syracuse, New York.
Yeah. That nobody ever showed up to, apparently.
That's right. No, the lights are still out. And so
fade to
why
black.
Why doesn't the state focus its resources on the safest investment you can make, and instead they're not. So under the Cuomo administration, for example, there was a lot of cutbacks to the public colleges, which led to all sorts of financial instability, particularly among the four-year public colleges, not the university centers, but the four-year.
Yeah.
A lot of them are in big trouble. Still, the private schools are different because there's no backstop, right? So if they don't have the revenues, they go broke.
And some have.
And it's easily, over the past 10 years ago or so, depending how you count who's in and who's out, there's, 17, 18 colleges or higher education institutions that have closed in New York.
Including St. Rose, right here in Albany.
Which is like a neutron hits the neighborhood, right?
So yeah.
5 years earlier, you have your little house next to the College of St. Rose. You're feeling pretty good about the value of your home. When they close it, it's not so good. And they still haven't figured out what to do with it.
Not quite.
They're still figuring out how do you deal with this whole facility. They had 90 parcels of property.
Well, it's a lot of land and property. That's valuable.
And it's not just here, right? So the schools close everywhere, out in, west of here.
To the north.
To the north, down the Hudson River. And so there's problems. And so our view is the state should be investing in private colleges to make sure, as best as you can, right? If you have incompetent management or whatever the thing about the college, for whatever reason, things happen, right? Things have to close sometimes. But it shouldn't be the result of public policy. And in New York used to fund provide assistance to private colleges. In the mid-80s, it peaked at about $115 million, which would be the equivalent of $260 million today. Hmm. The state pays now, provides under $20 million in assistance to private colleges. And so how does that even make – that doesn't make any sense to anybody, if you think about it. And yet that's the public policy. And so – if you want to stimulate jobs, if you want to help the local economies, if you want to help churn out the future leaders of the world, you should be investing in these things, not disinvesting.
We're running out of time. We're down to 2 minutes. I want to get slightly political. I know this is not necessarily going to be a Nyberg opinion, but I have to ask because it's the latest news. Now, we see that Mamdani, the mayor, has endorsed officially, now we knew it was coming, Governor Hochul. And she had endorsed him, of course, for mayor. So that's a tit for tat. But then, he's a Democratic socialist. Now we've got the governor's lieutenant governor, Antonio Delgado, running against Hochul.
From the left.
Also a progressive to the left, who just picked India Walton, who won that primary basically in Buffalo for the mayorship. And then the write-in guy, Byron, he did a write-in campaign, right? Incumbent and beat her. But you've got this really, and I think this is all over the country, this division in the Democratic Party, the extreme left, and then the more centered or centrist Democrats. And it seems like the Democrats, unlike the Republicans, in my opinion, won't fully embrace the left, the Bernie Sanders, the ones that maybe represent an all-out push for values of the party rather than the compromise and the mamby-pambiness of the center.
Those are your opinions.
Yes.
I'm not, just for the record, I'm not enrolled in any political
Nor
party.
Am I.
And so I, how I view these guys is as best as I can, as clinical as I can do it. The Democrats have always had this tension. It's not like this just happened. The difference now is that people label themselves differently. So Democratic Socialism, which, if you think about it, that's, Sweden, right? It's not
Denmark,
right? It's not the Soviet Union.
It's capitalism with getting your basic needs taken care of.
Yeah. It's based on the writings of Herbert Marcuse. It's not written on necessarily off Lenin or anything like that. So it's a different slice, but it doesn't matter. People use it as a weapon.
They call it communism.
And the problem, the tension with the Democrats is you do have now, particularly among young people, this rising interest in these kinds of ideas that capitalism has failed and that you need a different kind of model. They look at climate change as the obvious example.
Well, they look at the establishment Democrats in Washington and said, you gave everything to the corporations. You went for the rich and you're not living up to your birthright, which is to protect the unprotected.
Well, that's how people view the Democratic Party. But to run elections, you need money. And that's where the tension, I think, is really. It's both parties, by the way. The presumptive gubernatorial nominee for the Republicans, there's a lot of grousing that he's too left. even though he's a MAGA Republican. So, you know, I mean, there are tensions in both parties between the activist, more ideologically oriented members of the political parties. On the Democratic Party, they've been so-called Democratic Socialists. In the Republican Party, sort of the more libertarian right. It used to be MAGA, but now MAGA controls the party. And so, you know, there's always those tensions there. But for the Democrats, it's a combination of the, sort of their version of populism and how do you raise the money to run good elections. And that has to come from people that have money. And so I think that's the inherent conflict of interest in American politics. Mm-hmm. But that is the way it is.
Bernie still ran for president.
That's right. And he didn't win. Now,
no.
He could have won.
Yeah.
But they rigged it against
him. They didn't.
The first time.
Exactly.
But still, he didn't. And you can, I mean, Mamdani's a good example. But Mamdani, remember, he won because there's a system of public financing in New York City that allows you to cobble together lots of small donations to run a serious campaign. We don't have that in Washington.
No, we sure don't. And I just think it's interesting to look at the United States of America and why we were willing to go all the way to the radicals on the right, but not embrace the left of the left, which seems to me wants to help more people. In any event, we are out of time. He is Blair Horner, senior policy advisor for NYPIRG. Blair, I flippin' love talking to you, man. And I'm so glad you continue to come back. Thanks for all your good work. And we'll talk to you again real soon.
Thanks for having me.
Support for the Capital Connection comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.